December 28th, session of TeamSpeak for OpenHPSDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been doing some research on different protocols used in different kinds of radio programs, just to get a clarification of the differences and how they relate to each other. So that's what I've been doing this week. Anyway, next on the list we have Henry, PA0HJA, shown as recording in a way. Then we have Mike, AA8K, shown as recording. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.openhpsdr.org. Go ahead, Mike, if you have any comments.
Thank you, Dave. Greetings to everyone on TeamSpeak. Had a nice holiday with my son and daughter-in-law. They just left, and hope you all had a good holiday, too.
Fine business, Mike. And next on the list, we have Phil, VK6PH. Go ahead, Phil.
Thanks, Dave. Do I have audio?
Yes, you do.
Okay, I've been using the radio for a couple of evenings and had to move the mic across, so that's good. Thanks, Dave. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, everyone. Nice to be on the TeamSpeak again. Not much to report. Been working, unfortunately, over the Christmas break, but making very good progress with a number of commercial projects. It was good, but I did find a little bit of time to put my Atlas-based radio up on the air and work a few stations, which was quite interesting, despite the total lack of any sunspots. I used to work into Europe most evenings quite regularly, which was good fun. Nothing much to report on the radio front, I'm afraid, and doesn't look like there's going to be much as we move into the new year either. But anyway, greetings everyone. I hope everyone had a good Christmas and all the very best for the coming new year. Back to you, Dave.
Thanks a lot, Phil. And next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Well, hello, Dave, and good evening, morning, afternoon, everyone. It's been a while since I've been on here, and I just wanted to check in. And are on holiday here over the holidays, so getting some work done on the data engine, trying to get caught up, and making good progress. Goal is to get done by the end of the year, get the schematic done, so we can begin the arduous process of layout. And so that's kind of what's been going on here. And I guess I'll turn it back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Scotty. And next on the list is Bill, KD5TFD, shown as away. And I believe Bill is visiting relatives on the East Coast. And then we have Bob, VE3GKM, shown as away and recording. And that brings us to the end of the list. I apologize for being a few seconds late. I actually got on the other bookmark for the Tangerine SDR before I realized nobody was over there and I had to switch channels. So that's why I'm just a touch late. So we're open for general discussion.
Well, Dave Witten sent me a couple of links to the Jetson boards. So are the NVIDIA boards. So I've been taking a look at those.
Yeah, I got those same links, and they look quite nice, and the new Nano looks like quite a, it'd be interesting see what the price point is, but it looks pretty nice.
Well, that was the one that started out at $100, right?
Yeah. Did you see a price on it?
No, not on the new one. I bought one of the original ones like Dave did for $100.
Yeah, I have one here too, and but I haven't. We've been waiting for these changes. It looks like NVIDIA is standardizing on the bus for the Xavier and making all their new ones match that same bus.
So it seems like the new Nano will match the Xavier then?
I believe so, but I can't swear to it till I try it.
Yeah, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what is on the carrier board, because you know, they talk about the cores and the DDR4 and the eMMC ports, And then they say there is a gigabit Ethernet controller, but they don't say whether that is the Mac and the Fi or just the Mac or what exactly it is.
Well, having seen a regular Xavier, it does have gigabit Ethernet, so and it has that controller. But what I'm thinking, well, Dave had experimented with this Gumstick site, and they have a bunch of components already made up where you can stick them on with that bus, and then you can add or subtract the things you want around it. And so he was saying that the board that he built, that he designed, would work with this new module. And the whole thing with the whole NVIDIA lines is they're going with a module that's all in aluminum box with a heat sink on it. Then everything goes through the bus, and then the baseboard has whatever you need to connect to the rest of the world.
Right. Well, the idea is that our DE would be the baseboard, and we would plug the module right onto the DE. So the question is, what is on the module itself? Is there just memory, storage, and the processor, or do they include and you know, a bunch of parallel or a bunch of serial I/O, or do they include the Ethernet, Mac, and Fi as well?
It's usually just I/O on the board, the baseboard, and things like that. Power I/O. The Ethernet plug, and then they usually have a 40-pin Raspberry Pi bus.
Yeah, I see. I'm looking at this, and they have an M2 slot on the baseboard for an SSD. And then they have their, look like a quad row, 699-pin board-to-board connector, and then they show the module that plugs onto that. And what I'm not really interested in redoing the baseboard. I'm interested in what's on the module. So the question is, do they run like RGMII across the module connector, or do they run connections to the magnetics, or do they run, what is it? Where's the connection point? Where do they split it?
I don't know that. I don't know if Phil has any knowledge of these boards at all or not. Have you seen the new board, Phil?
No, I haven't, Dave.
I'll see if I can find. Do you have the link, Scotty?
Yeah, here, I'll put it down on here, on the bottom here. Well, that didn't come across as a very good link.
Is it an HTTPS or a regular just TTP?
Here, how about that? I got like three keyboards hooked up here, and I put my elbow on one of them, and it did bad things to it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is the
one. That was working.
Yeah, this is the one that I've seen.
But the descriptions are all of the block that includes the plug-in board and the baseboard. What I'm trying to figure out is what's on the baseboard and what's on the plug-in board, because I wouldn't use the baseboard. We'd plug it right onto our data engine, and we'd provide all of the gigabit Ethernet and USB and all that stuff. But I don't know what the interface is.
The interface to the baseboard is that 300-pin connector.
You mean the 699-pin connector?
Yeah, the big connector. And everything else is on the baseboard.
Okay, so I'm looking for the pin out of that connector.
That I don't... I know it's available because, well, for example, that Gumstick site has them available so that you can use them as a part in their baseboard construction. But I haven't spent enough time finding the links to know where it is. But it has a PCIe x 16 slot.
This is the $1,299. Is that just the module, or does that include the baseboard as well?
That includes that. You see, there's a big black box on the top. That's the module inside a big chunk of aluminum. And then the baseboard, you see a board at the bottom, and everything from that board down is the baseboard.
Do you know what the price of just the module is, Dave?
Well, it depends on which one. They have prices between some. They start at $1,000, and then there's one that's half price that's $600, and then there's another one that's half price of that at $300, and then there's one that's supposed to be equivalent to the Nano, and it would be down in the $100 to $150 to $200 maybe.
But aren't those including the baseboard?
Yes. I haven't seen prices for the NVIDIA module without a baseboard, because effectively, unless you have something to plug it into, they're unusable until you, I mean, they're basically a $50 part for the baseboard.
Yeah, I hate to think of how much that 699-pin connector costs.
Well, as long as it's you laying out the PCB, that's fine by me, Scotty.
Yeah, I don't want to have to lay that. It makes the 672-pin BGA look easy.
Running all those traces. Well, they've been rumoring that there was going to be a new Nano, and the Nano is supposed to be in the classic beginning Jetson series, like the old one. Because the other ones are a higher price, and the regular Xaviers have sold very well among universities because they're have a lot of capability at a reasonable price for a university.
So is the idea to connect the ADC directly to this block with so no FPGA or what?
Oh, you'd like to have no FPGA.
Well, that's one way to do it. Or you could, Scotty wants to hook his FPGA into that. But you see that you're going to have pretty good bandwidth between the board and the block.
Well, you get PCI Express, so you could put the small FPGA with the PCI Express on there as an interface to the 699-pin connector, plus whatever other I/O you wanted.
Yeah, and you know, control, command and control, it has I2C, so you can do that, and a bunch of other capabilities. But then the price you pay for the main block depends on how much memory and throughput you want through that. So it's basically the capability of the chip and the memory. And the CUDA cores.
So I'm on the main page here. It looks like they got the developer kit, which includes the baseboard, for $700. This is must be a lower performance one than the one you're talking about. Then they have a AGX Xavier 8 gigabyte module and a Jetson AGX Xavier, which doesn't say. User, so I'm presuming it's some out. Lower amount of memory.
Well, they were working on a 3-step memory or 3 or 4-step memory model, with the Xavier being the highest level, and then they half the memory, and then you get half the price, and then they half the memory again, and you get half the price again.
Okay, so this must be the middle one, the $700 one, so there's the $1,200 one and the $300 one.
Correct.
But like Phil, everything I see online here is it's all developer kits. There's no modules that are listed.
I think they're trying to get people interested in using these, and the actual module itself needs somebody like you to build a board attached to it. So they're assuming people pay for that, but it won't go down. The module, the blocks will not go down as much as, because the board's really only $50 to $75, something like that.
Yeah, okay, so the AGX Xavier is the high end, and then the Xavier 8 gigabyte is the middle grade, and then what that would make the Nano, the lowest one?
Well, I knew they were having a 4 gigabyte one, and I don't know if that's this one, or they were talking about having these different levels. I wish Dave was here, because he knows a lot more about these than I do. I just know what he's told me.
Yeah, on their webpage, it only shows two levels. The 8 gigabyte, which is the lower end, and then the non-specified one, And let's see, it's 20 TOPS teraops of AI for the lower performance one, and 32 teraops of AI for the higher one.
So I work with some guys who are in a data visualization lab, and they really like these computers for their work. And they say they do the kinds of things they want to do at a much more cost-effective price.
Well, it'd be interesting, Phil, to take one of these boards and build a PCIe version, you know, a version of your PCIe board that would plug on here, and that would also contain a gigabit Ethernet port, because then you could do your DFC right on the board and have a gigabit port. You could do that coupled directly over PCIe. And speaking of that, I know you've been busy on other stuff. How is that project coming? Is it kind of on hold, or is it progressing? What's the status these days?
It's really on hold. We had three runs of the Minerva board, which is basically ADC, FPGA into PCIe. And there was a problem with every PCB layout on the PCB. And the third board, Doug managed to cut tracks on the board and get his board to work. And I tried to do the same on mine, but I couldn't get my board to work. But he actually got his board working on the PCIe bus, and John Melton's software enabled you to set up multiple receivers on the Jetson board. And in fact, we demonstrated that in real time at Friedrichshafen a couple of years ago. But Abby's was doing the PCB layout for us, but he's been, you know, tied up with other projects. But it basically works, and the schematics available. That's open source. We found there was a few corrections I said needed to be made to the PCB layout, but and the schematic, that's done. And Doug managed to get some open source PCIe code running as well. I was using a library which was free for development purposes, but you know, you had to license it if you wanted production. But I found a open source PCIe library for the FPGA, and Doug implemented that and actually got it working. So I guess in terms of DFC, it's done. It's really a matter of now of, you know, someone running with it. But as a complete proof of concept, from code running on the Jetson board through to an FPGA connected over PCIe, it actually works.
Well, that's interesting. So really, because the Tangerine is going to have a high connectivity between the RF section and the FPGA, as well as USB 3 and gigabit Ethernet interfaces. But so the high-speed interface on the Minerva board is just PCIe. Is it four lane or one lane? What's the configuration?
It's on the Jetson board. It's four lane.
So it plugs right into Jetson then?
Yep, just plug the board straight into Jetson and away you go.
So you could theoretically take that and rip the connector off of it and reassign it to the 699-pin guy, and you could have a board that plugs onto the Xavier boards.
Yeah, or you could connect the 16 pins from the ADC directly into the Xavier.
Okay, well, how would I connect it in? I mean, this is what I kind of been looking for, is like, they've got a PCIe Express connector, and let's see, it is it's an 8-lane PCIe Gen 4.
Well, I mean, I'm joking. I mean, I've no idea. I haven't looked at this chip, but I've no idea what the speed GPIO would operate at.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it has some I2S port, an I2S port, but and a gigabit port. But like I said, I don't know whether the PHY is on the baseboard or on the main board. You just run the connector over, or I don't know how it's partitioned. But so I guess that's not really going to buy us anything, except it'll give us GPU cores that we don't get on the Tangerine, since we're using an FPGA, an antiquated FPGA, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, if you can, it really doesn't matter. I mean, All the FPGA is doing on the Minerva board is taking the data from the analog digital converter and putting it into PCIe format. There's absolutely no processing of the data whatsoever. So it was just a way of getting the data into the Jetson board as fast as we possibly could. And if you're only interested in 0 to 30 megs, then a gigabit works fine. But we want to go up to 55 megs or 50 odd megs for 6 meters. So needed a faster bus, and PCIe would do it. And the PCIe bus on the Jetson would work fine. That's what we actually ended up doing. But my prototype was an off-the-shelf Linear Tech LTC 2008, whatever the one we're using, and then connected into an FPGA board, an off-the-shelf FPGA board that had a PCIe connector. And then we plugged that into the Jetson, and that worked fine. That's what we demonstrated at Friedrichshafen. And then Abby developed the Minerva board, which was basically the ADC and an FPGA, the smallest FPGA we could find that had a PCIe interface. And as I say, Doug managed to get his board working by cutting tracks, but I wasn't successful with mine. So that was me off the project for the time being. But as a proof of concept, running hundreds of receivers, all on different frequencies, all in different modes, all in software, using the the parallel processors in the Jetson board, worked absolutely perfectly.
Okay, so then you basically took the 16 bits of data from the 2208, the sample data, not IQ data, but sample data, and you just interfaced that to the PCIe bus. It's, I think it's a 4-lane Gen 2 is what was on that part. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it was a Cyclone 4 we were using.
Okay, so then you just sent the raw data over there. So that FPGA basically just contained the PCIe interface and then a small bit of logic to interface the streaming data coming in from the A to D onto that bus, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I did the initial proof of concept, I found a commercial library which was free for development purposes, and I didn't have to write, I mean, apart from setting up the I.O. pins, I didn't have to write any code at all.
Well, but you had to take the 16-bit port and slice it into 4 bits and send it to the PCIe section, or did that have a 16-bit interface?
Basically, you set up a FIFO, and you just chucked tucked the 16 bits data into the input of the FIFO and recompiled, saying, oh, a 16-bit input FIFO, and it did it all for you. There was nothing to do.
Scotty, that's a little too easy.
Yes. No FPGA code, my kind of board. No, wait, Phil's kind of board.
Yeah, then we got at the output from the PCIe bus under Linux, you had a FIFO, and you got an interrupt when it said FIFO's full. And then you took the 16 bits, you did a FFT of the entire spectrum, and then you processed everything else from there in software on the Jetson board. And so it worked absolutely fine. But the three times of running the board and it not working, I can imagine why folks got a little bit upset, and the project's just been on hold for the time being. But from a technical perspective and a software perspective, it works fine.
Well, so what was the problem that it didn't work? Because, see, Doug got his working. So was it an impedance or a reflections issue, or was it a logic issue?
It was using incorrect pins on the FPGA, and you had to cut tracks, and some of the tracks were on the middle of the board. And it was a real, I'm reasonably good under a microscope on cutting tracks on the PCB, but Doug very kindly sent me zoomed up images of what cuts to track and do it, and I did exactly as he'd suggested, but I couldn't get my board to work.
So do you think it was just you were not able to cut the traces properly, or you think it's possible that it was due to the rework you got reflections or coupling or something on the board that you wouldn't have gotten if the board had been laid out correctly?
No, I think I'd for whatever reason I may have accidentally cut too deep or into the board or something. Scotty, it was a fairly simple mod. There was about 3 traces need to be cut and linked, and I did it according to the diagram as far as I could see. I may have damaged in the process. I may have zapped the FPGA or whatever. I don't know. But Doug's work fine, and I can see exactly how he was, why he was cutting the tracks and where they should go. So what he sent me was correct, and I may have just, you know, not implemented it correctly.
Okay, well, that's too bad that it worked out that way, because that would certainly be an interesting project. And so what was the plan next stage? Where are you going to take it after this? After assuming that had all worked, what would you do next?
Oh, we'd have the Minerva board would be rerun. We'd have a board with an FPGA. It was a transceiver. We actually had the transmit side. I tested that worked okay on the prototype boards I had. So you could transmit on multiple bands simultaneously, which was certainly new. But I'd played around with that with Bill quite a while ago using you know, Whisper and stuff like that, but people finding you on multiple bands simultaneously didn't go down too well with the Whisper authority. But the concept was you could actually have multiple receivers and multiple transmitters, and I just did a proof of concept on the transmitters, and that worked okay. And with the very low intermod linear amplifiers that the German guys have developed now, having multiple operators sharing a linear on different bands would be no problem at all.
Okay, so did you actually get to the point where you generated RF on multiple bands at the same time?
Yes, I did, yeah, we had that working.
But you were using DFC, right, and not just mixing and addition and mixing?
Yeah, I was using in DFC in the reverse direction, yeah.
Oh, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the problem I've got, and I know many other people have, is my, you know, I'm in a urban environment, and my noise floor over the years has just gone up and up and up. So what we're looking at doing is setting up a remote base station for the local club and remote receive site. And, you know, we want hundreds of people, club members, to be able to listen at once, which a single ADC will do now using DFC. That solves one problem, but how do you solve the transmit problem? So by using the DFC in the reverse direction, and you know, ultra linear amplifiers, and the last linear I tested, which was the 1 kilowatt one that Rudia developed. I mean, the IMD3 of the kilowatt was 91 dB down. So having multiple people using, you know, say you had a 1 kilowatt linear and you allocated 100 watts to 10 users, then, you know, everyone could be on a different band, different mode, different time, and the intermod levels would be fine.
Yeah, and you wouldn't even need any filtering, which you couldn't do anyway because you'd have the transmit carriers spread all over.
Well, I had diplexers on the output and split it up into, you know, each of the bands. So you could have what was interesting, you could have the same transmitter on the 20 meter output with two or N operators all on 20 meters, all using the same antenna, which wasn't sure had been done before.
Yes, that's exactly the kind of thing that I want to do over here. And I'm interested in the German amplifiers with the low IMD. Do you have a link or something you could post?
Yeah, if you go to Friedrichshafen, the Friedrichshafen videos under YouTube, then I don't know if I can find the link, but there was a series of year before when I was there was a series of articles on there, and since the article, there's been newer FETs come out, cheaper, less on resistance, higher power, you know, etc. So the market's growing very well, but what I developed was the envelope and modulation code in the FPGA, so we could provide the envelope of the SSB signal. But the issue is, and what's really held up the development of these transmitters over the years, is that you use a PWM to generate the envelope signal, which is fine. But if you think of a two-tone test waveform, then as the envelope goes to zero, there's a virtually instantaneous reversal in direction. And the amount of the bandwidth you need, say through a 3 kilohertz maximum speech, would be 10 times that. So your PWM low pass filter is now up at 30 kilohertz, not 3 kilohertz. So you need a high PWM frequency, and generating the envelope from INQ square root of I squared plus Q squared, and proved to be, you know, interesting. But I managed to pipeline the code and the FPGA and get it to work okay. But the issue is that by you've been through the PWM, your envelope is now delayed compared with, because of the, you know, the transit time of the LPF, the PWM low pass filter. So your envelope and RF are now out of phase. And what Warren did was put a delay line, an adjustable delay line in the RF. So you could then delay the RF signal. So the output from the PWM and the output of the RF were exactly in time, down to the fractions of a microsecond. And that fixed the problem. And once we got that going, then, you know, the guys doing all the hardware in Germany just ran at it.
Okay, but that isn't that doing the multiple carriers as a conventional, like the way we did it in OpenHPSDR with just taking the outputs, the IQ, and shifting it up in frequency and just adding them together, as opposed to doing the inverse EFC like you were doing?
No, that was just how we... That's how just how we got the INQ envelope signal and the phase modulated carrier for the envelope tracking amplifiers or the EET amplifiers. There was nothing to do with doing reverse DFC.
Oh, so this is to get the amplifier IMD down low. Is that correct?
This was to use a class C PA stage, so, you know, very, very high efficiency and very low IMD, yeah.
Right, but this is your envelope tracking technique that you use to do that.
Yeah, you'd feed the a constant phase modulated carrier into the gate, and the envelope of the SSB signal you'd use to amplitude modulate the drain.
I see, okay. So then, and you align it in time in the FPGA?
No, in the PC.
Oh, in the PC. So this is in Warren's code.
Exactly. Yeah, it's built into PowerSDR now. It's there. It's there. It's available at the moment.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
By the way, I put a link to the Xavier NX, which is the board that other page was talking about, and it lists the specs and a picture of the board inside that would be inside the aluminum block, and then. You're talking about the videos. The OpenHPSDR website has links to most of the relevant videos you've been talking about.
Great. I saw that, Dave. Thanks. And this picture of the Xavier NX, it's $399 in March of 2020. So that's what the module is going to cost.
Yes. Now, they aren't clear whether that comes with an external hookup board or not. But I assume they would have something. It does consume 10 watts instead of 5 watts like the current Nano.
And it's interesting because they talk about the AI performance, and it's actually lower than the Xavier, the full-blown Xavier, even though it's got 384 cores. That's kind of interesting. I guess they run the cores at 1900 megahertz for the 15-watt model and 1500 megahertz for the 10-watt model.
Yeah, maybe something like that. There is a difference in the max frequency on the GPU.
So is this the current? I guess it is the current one. It says March 2020 because it shows only PCIe by 4 Gen 2.
Yeah, I see that. And I don't know if that's
Gen 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gen 3. Sorry. But the other one said 8-lane Gen 4. So that's interesting. That's the one, if you buy the $1,299 kit with the baseboard and everything, I think that's what you end up getting.
Yeah, and Dave Witten has one of those full-blown Xavier boards. And friends of mine at work at the university have several of those that they're using.
One of the things I looked at when we were working on the DFC was to make the data coming out of the FPGA, which was interfaced to the ADC, look like video. And I see this has got 6 cameras up to 30 gigabits per second.
Yeah, these were really made to optimize camera video throughput.
It's interesting. I was in the Middle East recently, and I was just coming out of check-in to go through immigration to get on the plane, and just followed the signs and come out the other side, and there was the gate. And I thought, it's interesting, where's passport control? And I checked with a colleague I was with, and they said, oh, you've just been through it. And I said, where? He said, oh, it's done with face recognition. You don't have to, you know, show your passport or anything.
That's pretty amazing.
Wow, that's scary. What happens if my twin brother tries to get on?
You wear a different shirt.
Yeah, I guess so.
Are you guys identical twins? Scotty, are you guys identical twins?
No, I don't have a twin brother. I was just kidding in case. But I mean, there have to be lots of cases of twins that look identical.
How many CUDA cores has this got?
384, it looks like.
So it's keeping your CUDA core to price, dollar price, pretty close to the old Xavier.
Well, it says 384 core NVIDIA Volta GPU with 48 Tensor cores. So what are the Tensor cores, AI core? What's the difference?
Yeah, they're for doing AI training.
Okay, and the regular cores in the Volta are the CUDA cores, right?
CUDA cores, yes.
By the way, Phil, at the last DCC, I did an informal survey and figured out that there are more FPGA programmers available than there are CUDA programmers available.
There are more FPGA. Okay. Well, I took your challenge and added CUDA to a couple of my I was doing some FFTs, and I chose to do it in CUDA, and with the libraries that NVIDIA provided, I had to change one line of code.
One line of code to get from what to what?
Get from using FFT using memory to doing FFT using CUDA.
I see. One line, huh? That's pretty amazing.
So you're lucky I wasn't there, mate.
That's right. I mean, your one hand would count for 23 other hands.
No, I mean, that was a good comment, but I wasn't sure I typically was. But NVIDIA wants you to use CUDA cores, so in the libraries they prefer literally, you know, you either call FFT, whatever it was, or FFT brackets CUDA. I don't think it was as simple as that, but it literally is as simple as that.
But what fun is that? I mean, one line of code, that's not even a weekend project.
It's all these pieces you have to write in between those that are take most of our time.
Well, see, it's like this joke I heard that I think is based on real life. Supposedly at the GE plant, is it the Ford plant? Ford is having trouble with his generator, and they couldn't figure out. It was making a noise, and he couldn't figure it out. So he hired Steinmetz to come in and troubleshoot it. So Steinmetz asked for a blackboard and a hammer and a cot, and for them to lock the door on their way out. And 3 days later, he comes back, and he has drawn an X on the generator and says, hit the generator right here with the hammer, and your problem is solved. So they did, and it was solved. So he submitted the bill to Henry Ford for $10,000, and Ford was indignant, said he wanted an itemized bill. So Steinmetz gave him an itemized bill, is hitting generator with hammer, $1, knowing where to hit hammer, $9,999.
That's pretty good.
So it's changing the one line of code, $1, figuring out which line it is, that's the hard part.
No, it's not. It's just, you know, you've written all the code to generate an FFT and then do all your DFC. And you just write the one line you've already written, which says, you know, call FFT. You take that line out and replace it with the new library that NVIDIA provided with, which calls the FFT using their cores. As simple as that.
Suspiciously simple. It reminds me of another job that I was doing on an FPGA. And they were having trouble with the machine. It was actually a scoring machine for tests. It would read test score sheets. So you'd go in and take your SAT and you'd mark the answers on the sheet. And this would read the sheet by machine and generate a score. And they were having problems with the machine would crash anywhere between 5 minutes and a few hours. We just lock up. And then they restarted and everything would work great again. And they asked me to figure out what was wrong with it. So I went through, and it took me about between 30 and 40 hours to analyze all the code, because it was the Cyclone 5 FPGA, big one. And it turns out that the fix was changing one character in one line of code.
Well, that was quite a deal.
Yeah, because they had 4 clock domains in this, and they were using clocks in the proper clock domains most of the time, except one place in the code they used a signal from the wrong clock domain, and all you had to do was change the letter that signified the clock domain, and it worked.
Wow.
You feel bad about charging him all that money for, you know, 40 hours of work, but it was, you know, it was a solid week's work sitting in front of the computer with, you know, making notes and tracing out, trying to figure out which subroutines used which clock domain. And in the end, the fix was easy, but knowing where to make the fix, it took a long time to figure out.
So, I mean, one of the discussions we had a couple of weeks ago, what Dave and I had, was about using a soft core CPU in the FPGA. You're going to use a external processor like the NVIDIA, are you, Scotty?
No, that was just one of the variants, because the idea of this project is to have it be modular. So we're going to have different variants of the data engine. And I know Dave Witten has been pushing for a plug-in CPU type module. And I thought, well, NVIDIA, he's got one of those. The NVIDIA would be a good candidate for that. And so I think on a future version, we're looking at it. But we're still, even on the FPGA that we've got, we're going to use a soft core CPU, like most likely in NEOS, except that Dave's pointed me toward the discussion last week about the, what is it called, the soft RAIN or something, the core that you were using?
Yeah, the pulse RAIN, yeah. I've used the one you used before, the Peltira one before, and yeah, it's okay, but it's pretty basic, whereas this one, it's open source, and the quality of the documentation is amazing. This guy really knows how to write FPGA code and document it. It's a RISC instruction set. Everything's done in one cycle, so it's fast. You know, you can run this thing up to 100 megs if you need to. So, you know, but if you're happy with the Altera one, that's great if you used it before, but certainly, I was very impressed with the quality of this process. It runs on a Max 10, and just the quality of the documentation.
So is it more compact than the NEOS processor?
Yes. I think it's about, I think it's 700 registers, I think.
Okay, because I know there's several different versions of the NEOS that you can instantiate depending on how much performance you want. But 700 sounds pretty compact.
That's from memory. It's a while ago since I looked at it. But the one I've got, I got when they were doing the crowdfunding, I bought one of the boards, and it actually looks like an Arduino board. In fact, you can use it as an Arduino board. You know, you can program it with the Arduino programmer. All the I/O pins are the same. So, you know, getting up and running and using it. But I just thought being able to program it in FPGA as if it was an Arduino opens up the ability for other people to use that processor.
I think if we structured the code on the Tangerine SDR, we can make it like that, because, like, for instance, on the protocol for the Ethernet, what we do on our IQ2 is we basically have a state machine that's steered by the NEOS processor. So if you want to change protocols, it's done in the NEOS processor, not in the FPGA core.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, you know, in retrospect, putting a soft core CPU in there to do all the Ethernet setups, you know, the ARP and sending all the IP addresses, to do that with a processor rather than doing it in FPGA logic would have been somewhat easier. But I'd certainly, if I was doing it starting like you are today, I'd certainly have a processor somewhere, whether it's an external board or a soft core. But I say, if you want to have a look at an alternative to the Altera one, then I certainly suggest having a quick look, because the quality of the documentation and his code is extremely good.
The link is below.
Yeah, did you follow the link to see what the M10 board costs these days?
It's not available.
Oh, bummer. So you got a crowdfunded one, but they're not building them anymore?
Yeah, that's right.
Is the documentation available? I mean, he uses a Max 10, so we could theoretically program our data engine to emulate the M10 board, and we could put an Arduino connector leaf board on top, and we could have a board that works just like this.
Yep, it's all open source. Scotty. It's all the codes there.
It has a GitHub for the PCB project.
Okay, good, good, because we could do it. I mean, the max 10 pins are going to be different, obviously, because we're going to use a bigger part than he used, but because we're going to use the 672-pin BGA. But if you wanted to do, if you wanted to emulate this board, it would be possible.
Well, I was looking at porting his code to the Cyclone 4, and I got partway through it, but then my world had to change. So I never got around to finishing it. But if you've got a Max 10, then it's really a matter of porting it to different I/O pins. Yeah, I think it'd be a good idea. But also, you know, the Arduino development environment for the fairly simple stuff, I guess you'd be doing in the processor is very nice. And a lot of people, you know, can use it because Arduino is probably one of the most popular boards to work on nowadays.
Yeah, but what I'm thinking is in terms of maybe you could build a standalone radio with an Arduino sitting in the corner of the Max 10 if it doesn't use much resources. And you could run the radio, the GUI of the radio, use an Arduino Shield LCD plug-in board, run the radio and the Arduino on that corner and put the rest of the stuff in the rest of the FPGA.
Yeah, I think that would be certainly would be possible, Scotty.
So then you'd have a single board, a complete radio. Well, depending on what RF board you put in, you still probably have low power, but that's something to be fixed later. So this link that you found, Dave, this is to the old project and all the data's here, but there's no boards to be had.
If you click on, yeah, there are no boards to be had. You can find the old crowdfunded. It said successful and completed. But if you go to the open source link, there are links to the different parts projects in his GitHub, and he includes what appears, I haven't gone through it all, but it basically has a GitHub for the board layout.
Right, so you can see the schematic and the Gerbers and all that.
Yeah, just a second, I'll look.
It looks like has the pulse rain processor code here too.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want. Yeah. The other thing is you might be able to pick up a board on eBay, Scotty.
Oh yeah, that's true. I never thought of that. Why don't we think of things like that? Only for boat anchors, but this is a boat anchor SDR.
Well, I was wondering, is there ways that we could patch the development board, the Max 10 development board, into trying some of this code?
Yeah, all we'd really have to do is connect up the Arduino I/O headers, which is only about, 30 pins? Just connect those up to the pins on the FPGA on the development board, and I think you'd be in business. In fact, you might even be able to connect with the same exact pins.
Yeah, it'd be worth a look at that.
Need a serial port.
What do you mean, the serial port? That'd be one of the connections on the Arduino header.
Yeah, you need a serial port so you can program it.
Yeah, and that would come on the development board already. And plus, there's probably other stuff on the development board that's not on this pulse rain board, and vice versa.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the quality of his documentation, and he's actually written a book called Developing Embedded Systems. I actually bought a copy of the book, and it's pretty good. There's a lot of stuff on there relating to FPGAs, and a lot of it to do with time enclosure, which I felt was very was very interesting. I hadn't read anywhere else, so it's certainly worth a read. It was my sort of Christmas break book to read.
Now, by the way, I think I figured out how Terasic gets time enclosure on their gigabit Ethernet ports.
Go on.
They use a -6 speed grade part.
That's cheating.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Oh, you're going to like this. So I bought the Dave. Dave, do you have your Terasic board there, the one you bought from DigiKey?
Yes, I have to find it. It isn't right here on the desk, but I have it.
Can you look on there and look at the part number on the FPGA and email it to me? Because the one I have has a -6. It's a 484 Max 10 M50 DAF 484, which is the middle pinout part, 484 pin BGA, but it's a -6 ES, which is engineering sample. And the rep here says that there's no such thing as a real dash six. It doesn't appear in their price books anywhere. So I want to know if yours has an ES part on it or not.
Well, I'll look at it later, but I can't get to it right at the moment.
Okay, well, whenever. But that was one of the reasons I bought it, Phil, because it has 2 gigabit Ethernet ports on it, and they supposedly meet timing. And then I looked, and he's using a dash six part time, dash six speed grade part.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember. I mean, I think the current Virtus of Thetis that other people have done work on it since I've been unavailable. And I know there's a lot of work gone into the actual Thetis PC code, but also quite a lot of the CPU code. And I'm not following it at the moment because of my other things, but I think timing closure is not a good problem it used to be.
Yeah, I know on the IQ2, since we use a Cyclone 5, we managed to get timing closure, but with older parts, it's more difficult. And with the Max 10, I'm not, you know, we may have trouble unless I use the higher speed grade part. So we're planning to start out with that and maybe backpedal to the lower speed grade if we need to. And incidentally, this Pulse Rain board has a 10M08. That is pretty impressive because that's only 8K logic elements. So that processor, everything has to fit in 8K.
Yeah, no, it's pretty good. And, you know, as I said, I'm very impressed with his documentation and his code.
Yeah, that's something usually lacking in open source.
Yeah. I think the only thing I didn't like was the bus. He's using the standard, I can't remember what it's called now, but the standard Altera bus.
I know what you're talking about. It is synchronous, I believe.
Yeah, the overhead. I looked at it for when I was working on doing some I2C work, and you had to use, I can't remember what it's called now, you had to use it, and the overhead, it was actually, you know, many, many more logic cells than the actual I2C I'd written, so I got around it.
Is this the PMOD?
What's the PMOD?
No, the bus that he was, it's not the connector bus, but it's the software bus?
It's a logic bus inside the FPGA that you use to hook things together. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But you used I2C for your work, Phil, right?
Well, I wanted an I2C interface for the FPGA, which I wrote, and then I wanted to connect it to some other devices. And the code I'd got from elsewhere, I wish I could remember the name of this bus. Terrible. You had to couple it through this particular bus. I think it was on Open Cores, I think. And in the end, I just rewrote the thing from scratch and didn't use their bus.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, Phil. I can't remember the name either, which is bad since I use it all the time.
Well, the main thing I keep thinking about, Scotty, is this gives us many different ways to configure the radio boards for different purposes.
Avalon.
Yes, it definitely does. It's called the Avalon bus.
Yep, got it. A lot of the open cores projects, which I tend to jump to first, use the Avalon bus. But I found the overhead was too high for what I wanted.
Yeah, a lot of the IP has that bus as its default, so you kind of stuck with it.
Yeah, Roger.
Scotty, I was going to tell you, you got my email that I mailed you a package, and it is the TX1 or TX2 board, and it's the one that the power supply doesn't work, and I did take the HF2 and tested it with your B Micro SDK, and it did work there.
Okay, so it sounds like the problem's in the TX2 for sure.
Yes.
You know, that's easy enough, even if I just swap you out one.
Well, I figured I'd tell you what I did a little experimenting, and that one I couldn't get to work, and then the other ones worked well enough. There was something in the code in the B Micro, so that as you pan in John Melton's code, the whole thing slid sideways, the Spectra.
Well, you did reprogram the B Micro to use the HF2, right? Because you had it hooked to an HF1 before.
Yeah, I was using the HF1 code, but it actually gave a Spectrum.
And I believe the bits and the ADC bus reversed on the HF1 versus the HF2, so I'm surprised anything worked.
Well, I was suspecting something like that, but it actually produced, running with a Metis or Atlas set, it worked. It produced a spectrum, and I could hear signals.
So did you try running it with HDSDR?
Yes.
So when it came up, what did it say? It probably said an HF1 was recognized, right? Not an HF2?
I didn't run it with HDSDR. I only used John Melton's Lin HPSDR.
Okay, so you were running a B-Micro SDK with an HF1 with John Melton's Lin HPSDR code, and you unplugged the HF1 and plugged the HF2 in and fired it up, and it actually worked?
The HF2 worked with that, and I had been running the HF2 on the A9 board, and that was working before.
Right, but you ran the HF2 plugged into a B-Micro SDK that was programmed with HF1 firmware.
Yes.
Oh, man, I don't know that. That's a miracle if that worked.
I don't know how it worked, but I didn't bother to... I was just wanting to make sure I got something back out of it, and I did.
This is just proof that you can't trust users to do anything by the book.
They'd need a lot more complete instructions. And I was talking to Dave Witten today that one of the things we need to do on Tangerine is write some really detailed advice and actually make it probably into like lesson plans for here's what you're supposed to accomplish and here's what you need to know.
Well, have you looked at the user's manuals for the HF1 and HF2?
Yes.
Those are pretty detailed. I banged my head against the wall a long time writing those, and they even have a fact section and everything.
Yep. Well, I'm just thinking we need to find some people for the Tangerine project to help with all the documentation and making it kind of a STEM thing that we can for the ham sci part.
Yeah, now who did we have? We had a really good writer that volunteered to do that for HPSDR.
Who
was
are
that
you?
You that wrote those books, those manuals, or was it someone else?
Well, I wrote the website, but I didn't write the manuals.
Yeah, so somebody did that. Phil, do you remember who did that for Hermes?
I think that was Ken.
Yes, that's right. Ken, N9VV.
According to John Melton, he's a thorough tester.
Yeah, well, and I think if it wouldn't be beyond his capabilities, he would do it because he was kind of feeling that everything was passing him by and he wasn't able to really contribute anymore. But I think that's an area where he could do an excellent job in helping if we'd ask him.
Yeah, we ought to give him a shot at it.
Well, Phil, I looked on eBay and I didn't find any pulse rain of any kind.
Okay. What about just doing a general Google?
Well, the website's at the bottom on the links that I've posted, but if buying a board is what you're looking for, I didn't do that.
Yeah, I looked on eBay and I don't see anything, but that doesn't mean a Google search wouldn't locate it somewhere else.
Well, guys, we're over an hour and 10 minutes, so my wife's going to start wondering what happened to me.
Yeah, same here. I need to get back to connecting wires up again. So anyway, it was great talking to you, Phil and Dave. It's been a while.
Yeah, it certainly has, Scotty. And I've been off the project for quite a while now, and no sign of getting back, unfortunately. But there's others working on it, which I guess, and with your brand new project as well, that's great.
Now, Phil, you got to admit, you're having a ball with the project you're on now.
I'm absolutely loving it. Absolutely loving it.
Is it something you could tell us about?
Yeah, when I was developing the Chirp, I accidentally made a modification to the Chirp signal, which improved the signal-to-noise ratio an unbelievably high amount, which at the time I thought I must be measuring this wrong. But unfortunately, as you know, the Chirp died, couldn't get any interest, FT8 and FT4, etc. took over, and we eventually couldn't get the Chirp beacon monitored in South Africa because we were after the 2 meter distance record. And so I just left the chirp stuff and left it to one side. And then I was having a break a while ago and had a look at the chirp code. And I thought, I'm going to work out why this seems to work so well. And it's very similar to LoRa. So anyway, cut a long story short, what I did was I compared the signal to noise performance I was getting at different power levels with LoRa, and I was getting substantially better performance. So I thought, well, I'll whack in a patent on this, and then I'll see if it's, you know, if there's any interest in doing it commercially, because LoRa is very popular here and probably is in the US as well. And I found that the interest was enormous. So I've done a startup company which is using this technology as an alternative to LoRa, so much longer range, lower power, and based on the chirp stuff I developed.
Oh, that's great. So you're going to fold that back into the LoRa and improve it drastically, right?
No, I'm just waiting for LoRa to buy me.
Well, yeah, and then let them do it, right? Well, they'll hire you to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah, but it's good fun. I mean, I put an enormous amount of effort into that chirp stuff. And we built hardware, and you know, I was very disappointed that literally no one was interested. I gave presentations, you know, in the US and in at Felix Harman, and yeah, there's a couple of people come out and said we're interested, but it never took off. And you know, and to be fair, the JT stuff was going great, but certainly the signal noise road performance of the chirp is significantly better than any of the JT modes at the moment. And some of the tests we did across Australia at the power levels working on with were amazing. But anyway, so it's nice to actually get some return on all the effort I put into doing the chirp stuff.
Well, it sounds great. And it sounds like you're having a great time. So that's worth it, too. And I have someone here that wants to say hello to you. So go ahead.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm working too hard. How are you?
I'm not working hard at all.
As long as you got Scotty working hard, that's the main thing.
Yes.
You got to wait till I press the button. Yes. Fortunately, the yes was cut off.
No, I heard it.
Oh, well, that's too bad. Okay, well, anyway, it's great talking to you, and glad you're having a good time there.
Yeah, it's great fun. I'm putting, you know, awfully long hours in, but it's just like working on OpenHPO. It's hobby stuff more than anything else. So it's really good. I'm really enjoying it, and keep pushing on with it.
Yeah, it's hobby stuff you're getting paid for, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What could be better than that? Okay, well, I better let you go. And Dave's wife is probably wondering what happened to him. So anyway, great talking to you. Have fun. And we'll catch you on here next week. 7-3.